Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Before we get started, you can check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We most recently talked about Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, and also Snatch in one podcast. Before that was Dunkirk, before that was Prisoners, before that was The Thing. I've written a handful of things as well. You can check those out, themacguffinmen.com. Follow us on Twitter, at themacguffinmen. All right, take it away, Trisha Yearwood.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
Yes. Everybody's favorite period in action movies, the one where they all ended in ballads.
Oh, no.
And, like, dope ballads, too.
So we're finally talking about Con Air.
The people have been demanding it for years.
And now it's here. This movie's so sentimental at points. So many good musical choices.
Oh, God. It's just a fantastic picture. Con Air. The Simon West film, as opposed to many people I've talked to over the years might think it's a Michael Bay movie. No, it's a Simon West film.
Yeah, it is. It's a Simon West film that's also accidentally a Michael Bay film and very much a Jerry Bruckheimer film.
Yeah, I think that it is a Jerry Bruckheimer film, first and foremost, for sure.
What a great intro he has, though. Eh?
The Rangers intro?
No, his lightning bolt.
Oh, he does have a legitimately good production logo. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, but the whole video is just very arresting from the get-go on this one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, this was your choice to do Con Air.
you want to pass the buck immediately.
No, I'm happy to do it. I'm happy to watch it again. I think I've seen this movie about every 2 to 3 years, no matter what.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah, I've seen it a bunch.
Really?
But yeah, I mean, what made you decide that this one was worth talking about?
Well, I enjoy blockbuster cinema, and I feel like every summer I end up getting obsessed with some element of blockbuster cinema from the past once I start getting bored with the actual blockbusters that are being released on a weekly basis. And we're reaching the end of the summer period when I typically want to dive into these things. Like, I think that was sort of the impetus for us doing a Pirates of the Caribbean podcast like a handful of years ago. It's just like I wanted to think about how blockbuster cinema was 10 years previous, and now I want to think about how blockbuster cinema was 20 years previous. And the impetus for this is just me and two friends were sitting around having a couple beers and wanted to watch a movie. We watched this movie, and then we were blown away by how derivative it was of other movies of its own very recent past. And in one case, a movie that Jerry Bruckheimer produced the year before. And I just found it unbelievably interesting that way. It's also, I will say, a fantastic movie to watch while you're hanging out with a couple of friends that like to crack jokes and drink beer and watch movies. I don't think this movie should be watched sober because I don't think this movie was made sober. But it's a good time. It's a good time to hang out. And from a more academic standpoint, if I could describe any of my research for this movie as academic, I just found it absolutely fascinating how many touchstones of the 1990s in cinema we hit upon here.
Yeah, this was, as I said, I watch it kind of regularly. This is the first time I tried looking at it through that lens, and instead of just letting it wash over me. And yeah, it really was interesting in that way. And as you said, you know, looking similar to movies around its time, I mean, we can't call it an homage if it's something that recent by the same person. So you've kind of floated this idea as Jerry Bruckheimer as an auteur, which Jerry Bruckheimer is the producer of this and a very successful producer.
Unquestionably.
Yeah. And just looking at over his career and some of the accolades of him being listed, you know, most powerful person in Hollywood or on the Power 50 list or something like that. His work in film and increasingly in television has really put him in a very powerful spot. And I think everybody, and us included on this podcast, really downplay the role of a producer. And, you know, it's they're not out there as much. You know, some people reach his level where their names are more well known. But to the average moviegoer, it's maybe a director, but usually just the movie stars. And when a movie wins Best Picture, there's a reason why the producers go up to get it. You know, it's they have so much control over, first, what movies get made. And, you know, just because you have to get past them, what that movie looks like. And I agree. I think it's a fun exercise to kind of look at this one as, you know, if we'll look at a lot of different things about it, but look at it as a Jerry Bruckheimer film.
Yeah,
Or flick or Good Hang, whatever you want to call this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was thinking about like what other producers could sort of be described as auteurs, at least in, you know, in our lifetimes. The only other person I could really think of was Judd Apatow, who I think absolutely fills the Jerry Bruckheimer role in the world of comedy. You know, there are a number of, I think, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, I have talked to multiple people that thought that was directed by Judd Apatow. It's not. I would imagine there are some people going to see The Big Sick that think he directed it as well, you know, and it's just not the case. And I think that's sort of the only comparison point. Of course, Jerry Bruckheimer doesn't direct, you know, so he doesn't even have that. You know, it's even less reasonable to imagine him accidentally being seen as the director of a movie. But this one really, I don't know. I've never seen a movie that felt more like a producer's movie than this one, just because I've seen other movies produced by that same producer where he hired a director who I know more about than Simon West. And I've also seen a number of Simon West's subsequent films, none of which have the visual style of this one, you know? So I just feel like there's a lot of instances on the set of Con Air, Jerry Bruckheimer, like standing over Simon West's shoulder and saying, I think it would be good if we did a dolly in on the camera while Nicolas Cage slowly looked up, you know, like, it just feels that way, you know?
Yeah. And this is Simon West's first feature film. So he's really in no place to, kind of push back on that either.
Yeah. I mean, that didn't stop our boy Mikey on the set of Bad Boys. Bad Boys 1, but yeah.
That's true. He might be a slightly different animal than polite British Simon West.
That's probably true. And if we know anything, it's that Michael Bay is a truly one-of-a-kind human being.
That's right. <You know. laughs> But to put it nicely.
Hey, man. Michael Bay's cool with me, as will be proven over and over again in this podcast.
Okay, so if that's the lens we're choosing to look at this through, at least for now, this idea of Jerry Bruckheimer as an auteur, what are the signature things about it? I mean, is it visual? Is it pacing? Is it something thematic and more abstract? Or what is it that you see as consistent with what other things that he's made?
Well, I mean, the 90s Jerry Bruckheimer action movie, I mean, really begins with Top Gun, despite the fact that Top Gun came out in 1986, I believe. But, you know, in the 90s, you get, I think, Days of Thunder in 1990, which is the Con Air to Top Gun's The Rock, because those movies are borderline identical, despite one being in the air and one on the ground.
And it's the same star, like two Tom Cruises to two Nick Cages.
Yeah, that is true. But yeah, that's sort of Bruckheimer's first example of doing that. And then through the 90s, you know, you've got Crimson Tide, The Rock, this Enemy of the State would come later. There are some I'm forgetting in the middle. I mean, The Fan is a Jerry Bruckheimer movie that in the marketing looked something like this, but didn't end up being a movie like that. It was more of a thriller. But they're all just sort of big, beautiful action movies, frequently directed by people that have experience in music videos or commercials. And they all have a similar score, with a lot of like loud guitar, you know, the guitar that is so prominent in Bad Boys 1, because that movie was scored by Mark Mancina, is also incredibly prominent in Con Air, because this movie is primarily scored by Mark Mancina, and Trevor Rabin came in and finished it up. And they all kind of look the same and sound the same in some aspect, just because I feel like a lot of these movies were made in very close quarters. Like the pre-production and the post-production were happening in the same general space, and that's why you see so many editors on a lot of these movies. I didn't actually double check this, but my suspicion is a lot of the editors on these movies sort of bounce from movie to movie. They just sort of follow Bruckheimer. Not that these movies are necessarily being made concurrently, but it's just sort of like when this editor has a month, they can come in and work on Con Air for a bit and then go work on another movie while somebody else comes in and fills the next month. And that's sort of how it feels. And the same thing feels that way with the composers, because there's frequently multiple composers credited on these movies, like Con Air, multiple composers for sure for The Rock. There are multiple composers for Enemy of the State. And it just really, they have the feel of a weirdly like assembly line sort of production house for a movie. And that's just fascinating. And also that I loved all of these movies, despite the fact that they're all so similar. Like, I mean, these movies, I couldn't say I was raised on them, but I could say that they were a very prominent part of my teenage years, watching these on VHS, you know?
Yeah. So in a row for Bruckheimer, it's Bad Boys, The Rock, Con Air, Enemy of the State, and then into Armageddon. That's quite a run.
It's a very good run.
Yeah, no, and to speak to that idea about it being kind of an assembly line, but you still know who you're working for with the producer, like Bruckheimer, is that even if his tastes kind of change a little bit, you know, even if he's in a particular mood for a while and has a whim of something, when you have these people working by committee for someone who they've, you know, they're familiar with, someone whose work that they've seen before, but it's still so many people that it's hard to do something out there on your own, you kind of get this, you know, general idea that you chase down, and that's why I think things become so similar. I mean, that doesn't explain why some of the set pieces and why some of the posters are so similar, but it does explain why you get a product without a ton of variance.
Yeah, absolutely. And even in the writing of these movies, Con Air was frequently being rewritten. It's amazing that it only has one writer credit for Scott Rosenberg, just because it seems like other people were brought in to do a little bit of writing here and there. I guess Jonathan Hensley is the one that's been confirmed, and he gets a producer credit for his trouble. But yeah, apparently Con Air was being rewritten on set, which is very, which is another continuing thread from previous Bruckheimer movies. The Rock was as well. The Rock is, I think, the best example of various like heavyweights coming in and writing scenes here and there, and somehow it all working out. Like, we probably talked about this when we actually did a podcast on The Rock. Quentin Tarantino wrote in that movie, Aaron Sorkin wrote in that movie, and it's very obvious which scenes were written by which, and yet somehow the movie still comes together as, I would argue, the most cohesive of these Jerry Bruckheimer movies that we're discussing, with the only, I think the only other option being Enemy of the State, which I also think is a very good movie. But yeah, and Crimson Tide as well has a scene where out of nowhere, Gene Hackman or Denzel Washington, they're having an argument. I forget who brings it up, just starts talking about the Silver Surfer. And it's like, oh, okay, I guess Quentin Tarantino did a rewrite on this one too, you know? And so it's that sort of, that mindset that also applies, you know? It's the movie is constantly being worked on, even though you're supposed to already have a set script by the time that you're getting on set. And it just seems like every day something new is being written by the sounds of things.
Yeah. And when you mentioned the guitars earlier and just something about the aesthetic of a lot of these, this is a music video, right? I mean, this is, we get people who would come from the world of directing music videos and directing commercials. And there's that combination, you know, I mentioned it a bit with the, the sentimental music on the soundtrack. Your Trisha Yearwood, is that her name?
Yeah. That is definitely the name of a country music star. Whether or not it's the proper one that did the song for this movie, who knows?
It's that combination of, you know, that sentimentality mixed with completely over-the-top machismo. You know what I mean? It's like a power ballad music video, right? Like, it's still good-looking dudes being dudes, but there's still this this injection of sweetness that is supposed to round things out. And I mean, it's not that I don't like this movie, I don't find that they ever strike that middle ground. I just think it swings so wildly back and forth without being consistent, right?
Yeah, absolutely. This movie, I think swings wildly is a very good description of this movie. It's like every scene it swings wildly. You know, it's always swinging for the fences. It almost never hits it, but you know, valiant effort, guys.
Yeah, and I mean, but we've got some heavy hitters here. I mean, some people who are good at making movies and some great actors. I mean,
the biggest
Cusack is just doing like CGI work in reaction shots. Being, you know, I know he's not the most well respected actor, but I think he's good at his job. And yeah, there are just some talented people involved in this. This is a pretty wild product.
Yeah, exactly. So many of these movies are totally dependent on the people selling them at the core. And this movie, again, of all these Bruckheimer movies that we've brought up, this one might be the most absurd, and it also might be the one with the most talented people who are performing these things, you know? And some, it's not, you know, not their career best. Like, I would say, as far as action performances go, Nicolas Cage is fantastic in The Rock, and who knows in this one. But yeah, you got Ving Rhames, Steve Buscemi, John Malkovich, Cusack, as you said, who I'm not a huge fan of, but in the right place, he's great. And this is a perfect role for him, just to be the holier than thou sort of person. And even just going through the really small roles, McKelty Williamson, fantastic actor. Dave Chappelle is in this movie.
I know. This made me miss Chappelle's acting career so much.
Yeah. Trejo, Danny Trejo, MC Gainey, who everybody likes seeing MC Gainey in a movie. And just everybody is good, even in the smaller roles of people that we wouldn't really know their name. And that's so important, because the things they have to say are so stupid that you need somebody that's willing and able to be able to sell it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess that's what a movie star is someone who's you're able to kind of take the red pill with and go on this ride.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think maybe the most fascinating thing about this movie is, to me, at least the thing I became obsessed with over the last few weeks, is just the number of movies that it reminded me of, even outside of the Bruckheimer staple. I mean, we'll talk about The Rock very quickly right now. Well, I guess we've kind of been talking about it off and on the whole podcast, but I mean, it's called, just look at the poster for Con Air, the poster for The Rock. They're so hilariously similar. It's amazing.
Man.
Sorry?
Oh, I just forgot what the Con Air poster was, and then I saw it again.
It's great, right? Yeah. But I that's not uncommon. You know, that if you want to find tons of examples of people not being creative, just look at movie posters that came out around the same time. So, like, we can't blame that all on Bruckheimer so much as the machine. Or, you know, the Hollywood machine, not just the Bruckheimer machine. But that, there's the Welcome to Con Air / Welcome to The Rock
yeah.
scene. Also, and I think you can see a real difference in these movies just in comparing those two shots. The shot of Sean Connery saying Welcome to The Rock is just so much more engaging, and the musical hit that happens right there is just, it's like a well-made shot. Whereas this one, it just sort of, in Con Air, even though it's John Malkovich saying the line, the camera just moves in a little bit further. He just says, Welcome to Con Air. And then there's just like a little bit of shitty music, but there's just such a stronger build in The Rock. And I feel like that shot really represents a difference in effort in the two movies, I would say, which ends up making all the difference. But
yeah, well, this might be an accent thing, but I feel like if I bring up To The Rock to someone, they'll say Welcome to The Rock in the Connery voice, whereas yes. If you bring up Con Air, no one says Malkovich's Welcome to Con Air.
Yeah, that's true. I think it is. It's all about the voice for that. but yeah, and I mean, just even when Nicolas Cage, when Cameron Poe kills Wayne Grove from Heat at the beginning of this movie, the way that he stands up, like in slow motion and looking up, that's just like that he does the exact same thing in The Rock after he after he fucks up the Ferrari. And it's just so hilariously like just stolen, and it's just so fascinating. And examples like of shots like that exist all throughout this movie. This movie also might set the record for the most unnecessary ceiling fans spinning slowly in any movie, which is an interesting way or just a good way to add visual interest for almost no money to a shot. But yeah,
so considering half of this takes place on a plane.
Yeah. Propelled by giant fans. Yeah, so The Rock, so many instances of that. The Rock is also derivative of Die Hard, like so many action movies were in the 90s. It was the Die Hard on a blank sort of period in action movies. Con Air is, of course, derivative of Speed, just due to transportation. It's sort of like pre-derivative of Titanic. That's sort of more like there was something in the Hollywood water that wanted us to bring back disaster movies a little bit. I think something that's kind of telling about how it being a pre-Titanic movie is that Trisha Yearwood song is not on the soundtrack to Con Air, which seems so insane when you think of how many records Titanic sold because of that Celine Dion song, My Heart Will Go On, that closes that movie. If Con Air came out a year later, there's no way the Trisha Yearwood song isn't on the soundtrack. So we've got pre-Titanic, Silence of the Lambs, of course. There are multiple Hannibals in this movie. You know, John Malkovich is basically playing like snarky American Hannibal. And Cusack is actually playing, or sorry, not Cusack. if he turned out to be a secret cannibal at the end of the movie, it would take a real turn. But yeah, Buscemi. And I think my favorite one is Silence of the Lambs. It's Forrest Gump, because Nicolas Cage is basically playing action hero Forrest Gump in this movie, right down to the fact that his best friend in the movie is played by the guy that plays Bubba. And I just found it so amazing watching this movie and just picturing Nicolas Cage as the action hero Forrest Gump and just being continually blown away by how much funnier that made the movie, you know?
Yeah, and things just keep happening. Like, he's not out of military academy for a day before he murders somebody, is he?
I don't know. Like, it's never clear. Is he coming back, like, right from academy to that bar, the Oyster Bar, that he goes to where he meets up with Monica Potter? Or is there a period of time in between that is not really specified?
I mean, I don't know. And this movie does a great job of getting things underway very quickly.
Yeah.
He really wants to see her. I imagine he would go to his wife or fiance by that point immediately.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly feels like he goes immediately. It's just, I don't know.
That's a Forrest Gump level things happening all the time to you, though. You're right about that.
And just the way that he continually brings up his daughter's birthday, that something about that just struck me as so Forrest Gumpy. Like, he just keeps talking about the same thing over and over again. And just, of course, the drawl is such a important part, and the fact that Poe speaks so slowly throughout the movie. And again, McKelty Williamson, his role in this cannot be understated, because Bubba playing a character named Baby O, even the names are like kind of similar.
And then they die.
Yeah, exactly. Does Baby O actually die in this movie? I feel like he kind of, they leave it unclear, but
my feeling is having Forrest Gump flashbacks.
Exactly. That's the thing. Gary Sinise is not in this movie. I will say that Gary Sinise and his blue screen legs are not in this film.
The other guy from Of Mice and Men.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, all of that stuff is just so fascinating, and just in general, the way that imagine if Monica Potter's character's name was Jenny in this movie, like how unbelievable it would sound. It would be so funny.
Instead of whatever it is in this,
it's Trisha, which I remember Trisha Yearwood.
Yeah. So you mentioned Steve Buscemi.
The Boosh.
The Boosh.
The Boosh is Loosh.
I just had a kind of more of a script question for you.
Okay.
So when they land at, I guess, at Lerner Airfield, where they're stuck there for a bit, and he has his odd little play date with the young girl.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. What is the purpose of that scene? And, you know, we kind of get this red herring that he's going to murder her, and it's, you know, this kind of awful thought, and then that doesn't come to pass. You know, we get some weird singing together and some just weird camera work in that sequence as well. And then they get out of it, and she ends up, she's alive, and he's still got the doll, and that goes into the Sweet Home Alabama scene. What is the purpose of that from like a very much like an Exynos script writing standpoint?
I mean, from an X's and O's standpoint, this is a perfect example of a coach calling a timeout and drawing the X's and O's in the sand. Because I think what happened was they saw that pool, that abandoned pool on the set that they were already on. And then they're like, hey, what can we write about this? And then, oh, it'd be cool if we had an idea where we had what's his name? Garland? Mangler, yeah. Something Mangler. If we actually had him threaten to kill a kid. And then they wanted to shoot it in a way where they could leave it, like leave the scene where it implies that he does kill the kid, but they also wanted to shoot one more shot in case that didn't work in editing, that they could throw in later just to be like, whoa, we can't offend people this much. You know, like we got to draw the line somewhere. We got to draw the line with our casual discussions of rape. But yeah, I think that's just it. It's just they thought of a scene on set. And I think the scene is really creepy. I think that POV shot from the Mangler's perspective is like really, really off-putting and I mean this in a good way. I think the best parts of this movie are the weirder parts of this movie. And I find that really unsettling. And, there's something involving Johnny 23, Danny Trejo's character, a scene that I remember being really unsettling, but in a way that wasn't just done, or I mean it was done for shock value, but in a way that was sort of not just gross, like it just sort of, it put me in a different mind state and was effectively turned me off, basically, like made me feel uncomfortable, which is what those scenes should do if you're not a crazy person, you know. So that is my take on it, is that that scene probably wasn't in the script, and when it was written on set that day, that was the idea they were going for.
Okay.
Yeah,
that makes sense to me.
Yeah, do you have any other ideas behind it?
No, I mean I do. It's just it is such a standout, and yeah, there is some heavier parts in this, you know. You know, the initial crime committed by Cameron, and yeah, all the stuff with Bishop and Johnny 23 is obviously unpleasant for the right reasons. That one, just as you said, that one POV shot of her face, and it's kind of really loose and side to side, and it's
because it's handheld. Very, yeah, it's just very POV.
Yeah, but it goes like from right to left in a very odd way that you just don't see a lot unless it's like a trip sequence. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I suppose from a script standpoint, it was we're getting this cool action scene. You know, we're here for action. You know, we didn't come to Con Air for anything else. Sorry, Trisha. Or
either Trisha.
Either Trisha. That's right. Yeah, so we're here for action, but we don't want to be aligned too closely with the criminals. And I think Cameron's, you know, status as a criminal, as a convicted murderer in this movie, kind of puts us there a few times, so that when the police or the corrections facility, whatever the authority figures in this movie, come to the Lerner Airfield to try to fight them off, it kind of puts us in a weird place for who to cheer for, right? Because we don't want the cops to really kill everybody, and because we're on Cameron's side. But the idea of seeing them all get slaughtered is also not good, because as far as we know, I mean, authority other than one character is not really painted in a horrible light here. You know, there's sort of a miscarriage of justice, but you know, it's not this big anti-government, anti-justice department kind of movie. And it just puts us in this very unusual spot about who to cheer for and what we want. And we want to see people get shot, clearly, because that's what action movies are. We want to see some explosions and, you know, we want this just kind of visceral action sequence. But I find it just kind of confuses us. And I think that what we get with the Buscemi scene is that this is like these are bad people, you know, these are villains. The idea of them being loose on the world is something that even when you want to cheer for good action, you have to keep in mind is a bad thing, and it keeps you on Cameron's side within the criminal organization. So I think that creepiness is, as you said, it does a good job of unsettling you and kind of really forces you to pick a side quickly on that one. And but you can't do, like, you can't kill the kid, as you said. Like, that's, even in this movie that does some pretty awful things, that's such a cardinal rule. Unless you're going for a movie way heavier than this, you can't do that. And so I think they kind of really put you there, and as I said, it's a red herring. You know, they kind of fake you out at the last second. They give him the doll. We quickly go into Sweet Home Alabama, and then Garland Green is the one who even gets to make the joke about, you know, definition of irony, a bunch of guys partying on a plane to a song written by some people who died on a plane.
Which is a line I like a lot.
And it's funny. And it's a great line for Buscemi, too, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, exactly.
Place is so cold. To have a bit of levity there. So that's just what I thought. Like, it's this, they're tiptoeing this line where they kind of know where you are as far as cheering for the wrong side, and then they make it really dark really quickly, kind of force you to rethink it, and then they pull it back, and it's this comic relief but also this moral relief that just this quick trick that I think, as you said, probably was done in editing, probably was given a few passes over how to make that funny but heavy but important but not too dark all at the same time.
Yeah,
and I think it's just one weird little turn that they have to perform right in the middle to keep you involved but not to feel like a monster.
Exactly. And that it's what I feel like is the only POV shot in the movie, certainly the only one as obvious as that, but yeah, that's the only POV shot in the movie where and is also coming from the perspective of the criminal that pretty much everybody has decided is the most terrifying. I mean, how many people in movies that you have watched have you seen Ving Rhames be afraid of, you know? Any sort of Ving Rhames character, you just don't see him coming from a place of fear. But when Cyrus says, you know, open the cage or whatever, let Garland out, you see Ving Rhames like saying, are you sure, you know? And I can't even think of a second person that Ving Rhames, a Ving Rhames character, has ever shown like actual fear around in a movie, which I think really says something about where we're at with Garland.
Yeah, you're right. I think it's the fact that the POV shot, like, you're starting to cheer for the criminals at that point. Like, you're taking their side, and just that idea of like you looking at this little girl and that's a potential victim, they have to rein that in so quickly. And I just found that just an interesting piece of filmmaking to try to balance all those different things and to do it with humor and music and cinematography and dialogue, I think was this weird little move that they had to pull in the middle.
Yeah, I do feel like that last shot of the girl comes slightly too late. Like, you do think the kid is dead for sure, because you think the plane has taken off, and then they cut back to her. And it's just like, well, I guess she's not. But because I always remembered her in my head, she doesn't make it, because that shot is just such a throw in. Like, it was just, I think a bunch of people behind this movie wanted it to be released without that shot, and that somebody just at the end was like, nah, it's got to be there.
Yeah.
It's amazing how long we talked about that scene, but that is the most interesting scene in the movie from from the lens we typically discuss these movies from, you know.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, is this the movie, outside of being John Malkovich, which people know Malkovich for because of his name in the title, as much as anything else, but
his face being on the cover 40 times.
yeah, exactly. Is this the most prominent, like, is this the most famous role John Malkovich has ever played? Like, when most people think of John Malkovich, do they think of this movie?
Well, I guess it's the one where he's the diamond thief, right?
I see what you're saying.
When I've kind of thought about him sort of out of the blue, I think of him in period costume, which I guess is Dangerous Liaisons, which is I think a movie people, including Steve Benedict, respect greatly, but is obviously not super present in the public consciousness.
It was big at its time, though.
Yeah, I agree, but I don't think it's sticking around very well in most circles.
Yeah, and I think as far as like mass entertainment, you know, other than he does it in The Line of Fire, he's the villain in that, and he's very good, but he's wearing a lot of masks and stuff in that movie from how I remember it. And despite that movie being a very entertaining action movie, I don't think it really stuck around in the culture in the way that Con Air seems to have. Part of that is also the age we are in, that just more people we know would have been too young to see In the Line of Fire when it came out in like 1992, whereas by 1997, the time 97 rolls around, we're going to movie stores and renting movies. So I think just more of us have seen this movie, but I don't know. It did sort of make me think
of Mice and Men too, which I already mentioned, but I think that would be on people's list.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's also, I think that's important to the way we think of him. Like the same with Dangerous Liaisons. He can do anything. You know, he proves it here. I mean, give him anything, he'll make it pretty interesting. And it has been fun reading these reviews and the amount of people who bump it up an extra star just because the acting is so entertaining in this, mm-hmm. and not even just in a silly way, but that Cyrus the Virus is compelling for a, you know, what could be a pretty bland character. There's not a ton of stuff about his personality that makes it interesting. The way it's written, it's just that it's performed very charismatically, and that's what John Malkovich can do. But I think that theater and, you know, period piece cred that comes from Dangerous Liaisons and Of Mice and Men has a lot to do with how we think of Malkovich. And that's even infused into being John Malkovich. You know, it's him as an actor, him being a respected theater and film actor, not just a jobber, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And I think that sort of that theater pedigree that you bring up is also part of the reason he got the role, because this is a decade when all serial killers have to be played with by people with theater experience after Sir Anthony Hopkins basically defined what the serial killer has to be performed like in Silence of the Lambs. But
yeah, is there anybody better than Malkovich for like playing annoyed or like you're wasting his time? And I love how it comes across like that this is so below his weight class. Mm-hmm. Like he's annoyed to just be here.
Which by the sounds of things, he was annoyed to be on set.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I do not think he enjoyed the experience of making this movie.
It's kind of a mess, right?
Exactly. Because of all the rewriting that was happening, he couldn't draw a through line for his character. He didn't like the idea of having a new scene to perform in an hour, you know? So, which makes sense, given all that you know about John Malkovich. But I think the thing that I found interesting, and I think something that is a very positive conclusion for Malkovich, a very pro-Malkovich conclusion, not that there's anybody out there who's really strongly anti-Malkovich because he's the best, but is exactly that his career doesn't seem to have a defining role, you know? And I think that that's a real testament to his skill as an actor, is just that as I was thinking about him, normally even an actor, you know, in a ton of movies that I've seen, there's still some sort of defining role, like Cusack. I've seen a million movies with Cusack in it, in them, but he's always Lloyd Dobler, you know? He's either Lloyd Dobler or Rob Gordon,
Say Anything or High Fidelity.
Exactly. Yeah. And John Malkovich is just, he's John Malkovich, you know? and I just think, I thought that was really interesting, and I never thought about him, you know, as sort of career that way, and I just thought that was really cool. And I think speaks to his level of talent. Yeah.
No, he's way too good.
But also, like, there are a lot of good actors out there that still their career is defined by one role. You know, like, I love Brad Pitt. I think he's a fantastic actor. He's always Tyler Durden, you know? But I just thought that was really interesting.
Speaking of Tyler Durden, so much shirtlessness in this movie.
Oh, and that there's a moment where Ving Rhames, Diamond Dog, like, he's wearing a t-shirt, and then the next shot he is wearing that same t-shirt with like expertly cut off sleeves. Like, at some point in this movie, Diamond Dog goes from like leading people off the plane with a shotgun to looking around for scissors to cut the sleeves off his white t-shirt, which is just so funny.
Please, Mr. Dog.
Oh, yes. So sorry.
Yeah, speaking of people, you know, you mentioned this with the serial killers having to play by theater actors. And I was thinking about this with The Rock, too. I mean, Sean Connery doesn't... I mean, does he need to be in The Rock? Does he need to do that?
No, no, of course not. I mean, that's how they get all of these actors that are above the script that they're doing, is that they say, hey, would you like to be in this movie? And the actor says, no, not particularly. And then Jerry Bruckheimer hands them their check, and they say, yes, I do. You know,
they back a dump truck of money to their house.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, how true has that always been, though? Is that the 90s? Is that the 2000s? Is that up till now? Is it these guys want to be an action star, or is it really just a paycheck?
Well, I mean, the only person that the wannabe action star applies to really in this movie is the action star of this movie, Nicolas Cage. But as far as the character actors, because you are right, the 90s and action movies, it really felt like there were more really talented character actors out there, who like Steve Buscemi, who could play Garland Green, you know, in a comparably small part. Not that he's ever shied away from playing small parts, with the exception of Boardwalk Empire, that's his whole career. But I think there might have just been more talent in the character actor world at that time. I don't know, because like when I think of, and there might also have been more money for movies starring a lot more humans, you know, because when I think of recent blockbusters, we've done a podcast on Baby Driver. That's just a small movie. There just are not a lot of characters in that movie. Dunkirk was specifically made around the fact that there are no recognizable people, or yeah. I mean, the recognizable people are playing character actor roles. And something like Spider-Man Homecoming, which I think of the past couple months is the most comparable movie to Con Air as far as its placement in the summer movie scene. There just aren't a ton of roles for unobscured character actors. Like Michael Keaton has the John Malkovich role in that movie, and then it's just a bunch of bit parts. Everybody else in the movie, other than Spider-Man and even Robert Downey Jr., is a bit part in that movie, you know? And there just aren't these places for really talented character actors, or they don't stand out to me because we're in a place where there are just fewer really talented character actors, you know?
Yeah, just someone with 25 lines and a couple funny ones and a couple heavy ones, and then they die. That's kind of gone.
Yeah, exactly. Or maybe it's that, I guess now thinking more about Spider-Man, because Spider-Man was made really strongly as a comedy and cast as such. So many of those roles are filled by, it would be like Connor being remade and most of the people are played by people like Dave Chappelle as opposed to Malkovich and Ving Rhames, you know, just comedians who are acting. And you know, you get like a little bit of Zach Woods, you get a little bit of Hannibal Buress or these types of people that play small roles in a lot of movies comedically, but don't have the acting chops to sell it outside of comedy, you know, whereas these actors feel more like dramatic actors who sometimes tell jokes. Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense.
So like that's a long answer. That's also kind of a no answer because I legitimately don't know, but whether or not it's nostalgia for the period of movies that I watched when growing up, but it just feels like there was more talent in the acting class then, you know?
Yeah, just because of when we were born, going to a video store and saying, hey, I like The Rock. This one has the same cover. Why don't I rent this one too?
Exactly.
I try to be mindful of that because I feel like other people aren't mindful of that, and that, you know, they think Back to the Future is the best movie ever made, and I want them to know that that's because their big brother had it on for a very formative years.
That's because their big brother was watching it in the hospital while they were born.
So I try not to be too nostalgic for these movies. Or, I mean, I can be nostalgic, but I don't want to pretend that I'm not being nostalgic at least. So when we talk about how derivative movies are now and that everything's just pre-existing intellectual property and everything sequelized, I really try to take a step back and think that if this is any different than that, you know, if these The Rock comes out 1 year before this, and you know, if you say someone takes over Alcatraz to someone takes over a prison plane, these movies are even more similar than that makes it sound. Like down to certain set pieces and, you know, the arguments about don't shoot them down, those are our guys, or those are still hostages in there, and you know, Malkovich being Ed Harris, two people we kind of think of the same way, you and I probably, or similarly at least. Mm-hmm. Are these remarkably different, or are we rose-colored glasses this, or what is this?
It's a bit of rose-colored glasses, but there's also just the... There's just something about practical, anything practical that just will always work better for me, you know? And
it's CGI free by any means,
though. No, of course not, but it's certainly got less CGI than I mean not to pick on Spider-Man Homecoming, which is a movie I actually liked, but like a lot of Marvel movies just sort of feel like so flat and cardboard cutout because so much of it is either on a green screen for special effects reasons or on a green screen because Robert Downey Jr. wouldn't go to set or whatever, you know? And but it just gives this like flatness to it. And for all the shit we talked about Simon West up top, this is not a flat movie. Like visually, this movie is so opulent. The scene where everybody's walking from the bus to the jailbird and there are just fucking helicopters floating in the top right corner of screen. There are four different shots of somebody getting off a bus and a helicopter either just flying by or levitating there. It's just so funny. And again, to go back to when I was watching it with a couple of friends, we just laughed out loud the first time, and then they did it three more times in rapid succession. But I will say, real helicopter looks fantastic, you know? So I just think that it's, again, like, it is a bit of rose-colored glasses, but I also can't remove myself from the time period I was born and watched the most movies or watched movies the most times in my life, and that was a time when things still had to be done practically for the most part.
Even I love how that they destroy half of Vegas landing and then have a completely superfluous action scene in the other half of Vegas, like
it's
that
so
chase scene with the fire truck,
and Las Vegas known for its tunnels, you know.
Yeah,
I mean that tunnel is also in a million action movies. Gattaca, it's in Gattaca, it's in Enemy of the State, which is the next Bruckheimer movie, I think. I'm not making fun of Con Air for using it. It's just a good looking tunnel. I think it's in a Bon Jovi video. I think it's in the It's My Life video. But yeah, it is their understanding of, I suppose I've never been to Vegas, so I can't say that there aren't tunnels there, but my understanding is that there aren't, but you are right.
There are idling police motorcycles all over
the place. Oh, of course, they're everywhere. You just got to be ready. You never know when Cyrus the Virus is going to touch down.
I don't know, for some reason, the shot of him on top of the fire truck is like, I know there's so many silly things going on in this movie, but him looking at the camera there makes me laugh harder than many of them.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
And do you want to end on anything more substantive for this movie, or do you think wildly swinging from substantive to non-substantive would do this?
I don't know, because it's just very difficult to find substance in this movie. You know, it's not like I have some deep theory about how this movie proves who the Zodiac killer was or anything, you know, like I just do not think there is anything like that to be, or anything particularly interesting to be found in this movie. I just think it was made for a lot of people to see and a lot of people to be entertained by and a lot of people to never think about again. And that's what most, not quite Jerry Bruckheimer. You got two people talking about it for damn near an hour. But I will say, like, just as a piece of entertainment, it does work well. And to go back to something like Spider-Man Homecoming, which is, again, 20 years after Con Air, but is something that I think I will feel similarly about, in that it was a movie I saw that really meant nothing, and when it was over it was fun, but it was a very light movie, and I just don't really think about it that much. And it's the same with Con Air, but like I could see in 2037 finding Spider-Man Homecoming interesting for the same reasons that I find Con Air interesting now, you know, just as sort of a time capsule of when it was released. And the naked capitalism that I think really shows itself over time. I mean, we see these movies as the modern equivalent, again, Spider-Man, the Marvel movies, just as naked capitalism that just happens to please a lot of very vocal people comic book fans. But the Con Air was also nakedly capitalist in its time. I just think that as we get further and further away and we get to see Con Air as a time capsule, it becomes more and more interesting. And I wonder if that will happen with blockbusters now. I would imagine it will. I think something like Dunkirk will be super interesting in the way that I think we're going to see a lessening of dialogue in a lot of action movies and a ramping up of continuous action. And just these types of things that where as modern movies that are super popular get older, they become more interesting just because they show you where you came from. And the further you go back, the more interesting it is. It's why we enjoy talking about noir movies from the 50s too, right? Just sort of, it gives us a direction as to where Hollywood was. And then now that we know where it went, it makes it even more interesting, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, suck it, anybody that thought we couldn't make a thoughtful podcast about Con Air. But yeah, thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man, and be sure to check back next week.